Oak Session number 10928, Reel 2.
Duncan Bullman, Reel 2. Yes, I was asking you about this issue of the trial and whether or not you thought a British officer could be labelled a war criminal for ordering the repatriation.
I don't think it would happen very often, but certainly I know that during the war there were times when we ordinary soldiers thought that our brigadier was doing criminal things by ordering people to advance into certain death. And this situation in Austria was more political than that, but again one could understand that a wrong decision might easily be taken.
The issue today, you know, do you think, what do you think should have happened to those Russians? Do you have any particular feelings about it?
Well, there were very many displaced persons in Europe after the war, and I think we would all have been far happier had the Russians been sent to displaced persons camps rather than returned. But of course, unfortunately, it went back to the Yalta Agreement, and Churchill would have had to have told Stalin that he'd changed his mind. In retrospect now, it seems a pity that we didn't change our mind.
Well, one of the reasons has been given that, you know, Austria was so chaotic at the time with all the displaced persons, you know, the refugees, the shortages, and of course the threat from Tito. Do you think that there is anything in that to justify the action that was taken in sending those people back? Would you say Austria was confused and chaotic at that time? I suppose we're talking of May and June 1945, aren't we?
No, I would not say it was continuously chaotic. I was in and out of the country for most of the following year. And during that time, life in the towns was lived in quite a civilized fashion. The university was open, people were teaching, theatre was open, you could go to operettas and so on. There was no extremity to force anyone to be repatriated against their will.
And another reason has been given, you know, the threat of Tito and the demands he was making in the area that you mentioned earlier. Were you ever at any time put on an alert for anything that the Yugoslavs might be preparing? Do you remember?
I don't think we anticipated any military action from Tito. And indeed, having come up as a victorious army from Italy, I don't think we felt that Tito was any threat to us. We were much stronger than he could have been.
I wonder if I could ask you some questions about your experience with tanks in World War II. Because I understand you went into the tanks in, was it spring 1943?
Yes. I was then at base depot in Cairo, and I was sent on a course. I had been an officer in the Royal Armoured Corps, which covered armoured car regiments and tank regiments. And this was the first time I'd been on an actual tank course. And at that time, the latest tanks were the American Shermans and Grants. The Sherman was to prove a war-winning tank. The great virtue of it was that it would keep going. Later in the war, in the following year, we got British Churchills, and they were far less reliable. Each troop in a tank squadron consists of three tanks, and I think the first rule for a troop leader is to get his three tanks into action. When we had Churchills, we could never travel a mile down the road without having one tank break down. In the Shermans, you could travel 200 miles on your tracks, and then the tank was still fit to go into action. A very important difference. Of course, the thickness of the armor is one concern. That is most important if there is a tank versus tank battle. But when tanks are supporting the infantry, which was usually the case in the mountainous country of Italy, then the tank armor keeps out the machine gun bullets, which are the main danger to life. A tank has a turret which rotates, and in the turret is a big gun, which would either be a 6-pounder or a 75mm, and also a machine gun, which is quick firing. And then there would be an instrument for firing smoke grenades and similar things to give cover.
Was manoeuvrability, was that an important factor? You know, how you could sort of twirl and swirl around?
Yes. Again, for the troop commander to get all his tanks into action, as well as depending on the mechanical reliability, you have to make sure that the tank doesn't throw a track, because it has a track on either side, and if a track comes off, then the tank is immobilized. Now, you soon learn that the important rule is to take any obstacle square on, whether it's a steep bank that you're going over the top of, or whether it's a deep ditch that you're going down and up. In both cases, you must get square on and keep going straight. If you try and go diagonally, you'll shed a track.
Did that often happen, you know, that you would shed tracks?
Oh, yes. I mean, when you're in action and a lot of things are happening and you haven't very much time to think, if you're not careful, you could shed a track. But here again, it's experience versus enthusiasm. And the wise man is the one who thinks first.
That would make you very vulnerable, presumably, if you shed a track. You would be disabled, would you?
Yes. You'd be immobilised.
How do you think the tanks that you had experience of, and this would be the Shermans and the Churchills, how did these compare with the German tanks that you experienced?
Well, during the war, the German tanks usually had superior firepower. In other words, their guns could penetrate the British armour more easily than British guns could penetrate the German armour. The crew of a tank would consist of five people, a driver and co-driver, and a tank commander, a wireless operator, and a gunner. And of course, the best crews were the ones who had learned to work together.
How about the American, you know, apart from the Sherman tanks? One sees these enormous tanks, you know, the size of houses almost. Did you ever have any experience of those or see them in action? The enormous American machines. And the Germans had some as well, I think, didn't they? Enormous.
Well, the biggest German tanks were the Tiger and the Panther. They, of course, had tremendous firepower, and for their weight, they were remarkably fast and manoeuvrable. But clearly there's a relationship between the weight of a tank and the speed at which it can travel, and the size of the engine. Another important feature in tank battles is you do not want your engine to be hit, because then it may go up in flames. And that is dangerous for the crew, as well as immobility for the tank. Great advantage of living and fighting in a tank is that you take all your household goods with you. Your bedroll and your food and so on. The poor old infantryman has to carry it.
I suppose it's like a little home, isn't it? The inside of your...
Yes.
Your tank, yes. Did you have any firefighting apparatus within the tank?
I expect we did, but I honestly can't remember what it was.
Because fire must have been one of the biggest risks, wasn't it, for
yes.
a tankman. Did you ever have any casualties with your crew?
Well, I was extremely fortunate during the war. In action, I had really two separate troops. The first one was a recce troop, which were honey tanks with no turret, and every man in my troop was wounded at some time, but not one of them was killed, and for that I was very thankful. Of course, it can't all be put down to my skill. The fact of the matter is, in war, you are standing on top of your tank with your gunner beside you. A shell bursts in a tree close by. He may get a bit of shrapnel, and you are unscathed. Again, that piece of shrapnel may go through his head, and he's then a dead man, or it may go in some fleshy part of his leg. I was very fortunate that nobody was killed.
What types of battle were you involved in? You know, I wondered if you could give me some different examples of tank battles in World War II.
Well, we were in support of the infantry, and usually a battle would begin with a night attack by the infantry, and there'd be a lot of machine gun fire. And then the tanks would move up to give closer to support to the infantry. Sometimes battles were fast and furious. I can remember one occasion going forward with the tanks. The enemy were shelling us. The infantry were down in their trenches. And on one occasion, my tank ran straight over the top of some trenches in which tiny little Gurkhas were sheltering. Fortunately, the trench held up and we didn't squash them. And all the time, shells were falling all around, and I was praying that none of them landed inside my tank, which would have been the end. But I was lucky. The only time that my tank got a direct hit, I was parked outside a house, and I had taken all my crew and myself and the radio inside the house, so that when a shell landed in the middle of my tank and it went up in flames, none of us was wounded. That was very fortunate.
Yes, I imagine that, you know, the burns could be pretty horrible, you know, in tanks. Is that right?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Well, there again, that day, if I had been parking my tank, I would always put a house or something solid between my tank and the enemy. On this particular day, a vehicle had broken down on the road leading towards the enemy, and I had been sent out to tow the vehicle away. Whilst I was doing that job, somebody came and pinched my sight in the shelter of the house. So when I came back, I was forced to park on the other side of the house, and thus my tank was exposed. This is how things happen in war.
I suppose a tank battle in a place like Italy would be very different from one in the desert. Am I right in thinking that?
Absolutely different, yes. In the desert, you have open terrain, and a tank battle would be a squadron or several squadrons of tanks fighting against each other. Now, in those circumstances, you have to take advantage of any slope in the land. And it is surprising, but nearly everywhere you go, although in general you'd say it's flat country, in point of fact, there are little slopes and dips where most of the tank can be hidden. So the best position is to have your tank what we called hull down. That's to say, the tracks and body of the tank are hidden, and you just see the turret and the gun over the top of the slope. In this position, you afford the enemy the smallest possible target.
How about finding your way in the desert? One imagines that you don't have a lot of landmarks. Were there problems in that respect?
Well, certainly. I arrived in Egypt in June 1942, and I was 3 weeks at base depot. And during those 3 weeks, I was taught stoppages on the water-cooled Vickers machine gun. This was one of the main weapons in World War I. I had never seen one before, and I never saw one during the rest of the war. Nobody thought to teach me how to use a sun compass. My map reading exercises in England had taught me that you looked on your map, you saw a church steeple or a railway or a bridge, and you said, this is where I am. When you get out in the desert and the land all around you is flat and there are no steeples, no buildings, nothing except possibly the odd barrel, then it's very difficult indeed to say where you are. Indeed, during the desert campaign, it was quite common for a bunch of soldiers in a vehicle to lose themselves, and when they thought they were in front of the enemy, to suddenly discover they were behind. So, to me, it seems criminal that nobody taught me in advance how to use a sun compass.
Did you learn, on the spot? Were you able to learn that while you were actually in the desert?
Yes. The regiment had sun compasses, and of course, one of the first things one asked one's instructors was how to use them.
So how did the sort of fighting in the desert compare with, say, a tank battle in Italy? I know you were involved in the Gothic line attack, weren't you? And I wondered if, you could perhaps compare it with that for me.
Well, in Italy, the terrain really decided where battles took place. And it was very seldom that one made an advance which you could measure in miles. In Egypt, the battle line was decided by where the enemy had put his defences, in the main his mines and his guns. And once you broke through those defences, then the enemy might retreat for 50 or 100 miles. And what stopped you chasing him was that when you'd gone so many miles, you ran out of petrol or water. And so you had to stop and wait for replenishment.
How did that come? How would you get a replenishment of fuel and water when you were stuck out in the desert?
The good old service corps, the RASC, they did a very good job. But again, in many cases, the British were weak. All our petrol used to come up in square tins. We called them, I forget what we did call them, tins, I suppose. They had their uses. I mean, they could be made into latrines and things. But the trouble was that very often they arrived and half of the petrol had leaked out of them. Whereas the Germans had a much stronger container, which we called a jerry can, and it had a buckled cap on top, which was quite petrol proof, and these had a much longer life. I think the British tins, once they'd been emptied, they were thrown away, you know, whereas the jerry cans could be refilled and used again.
Yes, you were going to tell me about the Gothic line, weren't you? That attack that you were involved in.
Yes. Well, the Gothic line was in Italy, in the area of Urbino, and it ran along the river Foglia. And here the Germans had prepared their defences, and we had Sherman tanks, and we did an approach march of some 200 miles in our Shermans. And then, without delay, we went into action. The first thing we had to do was to find out where the enemy were, and this was a job for the recce troop. I had a squadron leader who was absolutely first class, and he said to me, "Come on, hop into my jeep, we'll go and find where the Germans are." So off we went. And we followed the road as far as we could till we came to a place where it had been blown and was impassable. So he and I got out, and we walked round the blow and did a reconnaissance. And when we came back, we found that our Indian driver had prodded around the blown road and discovered some anti-personnel mines. So we were very grateful that he was there. Otherwise, we might have trodden on a mine. And if you did, that was either the end, or at least you got very badly hurt. Well, we caught up with the Germans, and my regiment was ordered to lead the tanks down to cross the river Foglia. And then we had to climb up the steep hill the other side to the village of Monte Calvo. And as we came up the hill, the Germans were in front of us, and they had machine guns and rifles and mortars, and they were sending over everything they could. And we, of course, were supporting our infantry and shooting at the Germans. And we had quite a dusty battle, but by the end of the day, we had driven the Germans back, and they retreated to the next village. Our casualties, fortunately, were not heavy. We had one or two men wounded, but nobody killed.
Your squadron leader, you know, leaping into the jeep and doing the recce with yourself, would that have been unusual for a squadron leader to have done that?
Well, yes, because in general, a squadron leader stays back with his headquarters and ordered his troops to go forward. In this case, the squadron was stationary in one place, and instead of sending me alone as reconnaissance officer, he chose to come with me to do the reconnaissance. And then, of course, when he got back, he was able to issue orders to his tanks. But he was a first-class man.
Yes, what was his name?
John Warner.
I think you were mentioned in dispatches, were you not?
Yes, yes. Well, that again was probably due to a recommendation by my squadron leader. He, I'm glad to say, was awarded the MC, and if anyone deserved it, he thoroughly did.